benefit the top 1%, the very wealthy and the biggest corporation, and exploded the federal deficit. They added more to the national debt than any presidential term in American history. Check the numbers. Folks at home, does anybody really think the tax code is fair?
No!
Do you really think the wealthy and big corporations need another $2 trillion tax break?
No!
I sure don't. I'm going to keep fighting like hell to make it fair. Under my plan, nobody earning less than $400,000 a year will pay an additional penny in federal taxes. Nobody, not one penny. And they haven't yet. In fact, the child tax credit I passed during the pandemic cut taxes for millions of working families and cut child poverty in half. Restore that child tax credit. No child should go hungry in this country. The way to make the tax code fair is to make big corporations and the very wealthy begin to pay their fair share. Remember in 2020, 55 of the biggest companies in America made $40 billion and paid zero in federal income tax. Zero. Not anymore. Thanks to the law I wrote and we signed, big companies have to pay a minimum of 15%. But that's still less than working people pay in federal taxes. It's time to raise corporate minimum tax to at least 21%. So every big corporation finally begins to pay their fair share. I also want to end tax breaks for big pharma, big oil, private jets, massive executive pay when it's only supposed to be $1 million that could be deducted. They can pay them $20 million if they want, but deduct $1 million. End it now. You know, there are 1,000 billionaires in America. You know what the average federal tax is for those billionaires? No. They're making great sacrifices, 8.2%. That's far less than the vast majority of Americans pay. No billionaire should pay a lower federal tax rate than a teacher, a sanitation worker, or a nurse. A minimum tax for billionaires of 25%, just 25%. You know what that would raise? That would raise $500 billion over the next 10 years. And imagine what that could do for America. Imagine a future with affordable child care. Millions of families can get they need to go to work to help grow the economy. Imagine a future with paid leave, because no one should have to choose between working and taking care of their sick family member. Imagine the future of home care and elder care and people living with disabilities so they can stay in their homes and family caregivers can finally get the pay they deserve. Tonight, let's all agree once again to stand up for seniors. Many of my friends on the other side of the aisle want to put Social Security on the chopping block. If anyone here tries to cut Social Security, Medicare, or raise the retirement age, I will stop you. The working people who built this country pay more into Social Security than millionaires and billionaires do. It's not fair. We have two ways to go. Republicans can cut Social Security and give more tax breaks to the wealthy. That's the proposal. Oh, no. You guys don't want another $2 trillion tax cut? I kind of thought that's what your plan was. Well, that's good to hear. You're not going to cut another $2 trillion for the super wealthy. That's good to hear. I'll protect and strengthen Social Security and make the wealthy pay their fair share. Look. Corporations raise prices to pad their profits, charging more and more for less and less. That's why we're cracking down on corporations that engage in price gouging and deceptive pricing, from food to health care to housing. In fact, the snack companies think you won't notice if they change the size of the bag and put a hell of a lot fewer, same size bag, put fewer chips in it. No, I'm not joking. It's called shrinkflation. Pass Bobby Casey's bill and stop this. I really mean it. You probably all saw that commercial on Snickers bars. You get charged the same amount, and you got about, I don't know, 10% fewer Snickers in it. Look, I'm also getting rid of junk fees, those hidden fees at the end of your bill that are there without your knowledge. My administration announced we're cutting credit card late fees from $32 to $8. Banks and credit card companies are allowed to charge what it costs them to instigate the collection. And that's more, a hell of a lot, like $8 and 30-some dollars. They don't like it. Credit card companies don't like it. But I'm saving American families $20 billion a year with all the junk fees I'm eliminating. Folks at home, that's why the banks are so mad, is $20 billion in profit. I'm not stopping there. My administration has proposed rules to make cable, travel, utilities, and online ticket sellers tell you the total price up front so there are no surprises. It matters. It matters. And so does this. In November, my team began serious negotiations with a bipartisan group of senators. The result was a bipartisan bill with the toughest set of border security reforms we've ever seen. Oh, you don't think so? Oh, you don't like that bill, huh? That conservatives got together and said it was a good bill? I'll be darned. That's amazing. That bipartisan bill would hire 1,500 more security agents and officers, 100 more immigration judges to help tackle the backload of 2 million cases, 4,300 more asylum officers, and new policies so they can resolve cases in 6 months instead of 6 years now.
He needs to slow it down a little bit, right?
I think he's doing fine. I don't mind the speed.
I think he means for his bet. 100 more high-tech drug detection machines to significantly increase the ability to screen and stop vehicles smuggling fentanyl into America. That's killing thousands of children. This bill would save lives and bring order to the border. It would also give me and any new president new emergency authority to temporarily shut down the border when the number of migrants at the border is overwhelming. The Border Patrol Union has endorsed this bill. The Federal Chamber of Commerce is, you're saying low. Look at the facts. I know.
Point.
I know you know how to read. I believe that given the opportunity for a majority in the House and Senate would endorse the bill as well, a majority right now. But unfortunately, politics has derailed this bill so far. I'm told my predecessor called members of Congress in the Senate to demand they block the bill. He feels a political win. He viewed it as would be a political win for me and a political loser for him. It's not about him. It's not about me. I'd be a winner. Not really.
It's Marjorie Taylor Greene speaking up about Lake and Riley in Georgia. Wanting him to say her name.
An innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal. That's right. But how many of the thousands of people being killed by illegals? To her parents, I say, my heart goes out to you, having lost children myself. I understand. But look, if we change the dynamic at the border, people pay these smugglers $8,000 to get across the border because they know if they get by and let into the country, it's 6 to 8 years before they have a hearing. and it's worth taking the chance of the $8,000. But if it's only 6 weeks, the idea is it's highly unlikely that people will pay that money and come all that way knowing that they'll be able to be kicked out quickly. Folks, I would respectfully suggest my Republican friends owe it to the American people, get this bill done. We need to act now. And if my predecessor is watching, instead of paying politics and pressuring members of Congress to block the bill, join me in telling the Congress to pass it. We can do it together. But that's what he apparently hears, what he will not do. I will not demonize immigrants saying they are poison in the blood of our country. I will not separate families. I will not ban people because of their faith. Unlike my predecessor, on my first day in office, I introduced a comprehensive bill to fix our immigration system. Take a look at it, as all these and more. Secure the border, provide a pathway to citizenship for dreamers, and so much more. But unlike my predecessor, I know who we are as Americans. We're the only nation in the world with a heart and soul that draws from old and new. Home to Native Americans and ancestors have been here for thousands of years. Home to people of every place, from every place on earth. They came freely. Some came in chains. Some came when famine struck, like my ancestral family in Ireland. Some to flee persecution, to chase dreams that are impossible anywhere but here in America. That's America. And we all come from somewhere, but we're all American. Look, folks, we have a simple choice. We can fight about fixing the border, or we can fix it. I'm ready to fix it. Send me the border bill now. A transformational moment in history happened 59 years ago today in Selma, Alabama. Hundreds of foot soldiers for justice marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, named after the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, to claim their fundamental right to vote. They were beaten, they were bloody, and left for dead. Our late friend and former colleague John Lewis was on that march. We miss him. Joining us tonight are other marchers, both in the gallery and on the floor, including Betty Mae Fikes, known as the Voice of Selma. The daughter of gospel singers and preachers, she sang songs of prayer and protest on that bloody Sunday to help shake the nation's conscience. 5 months later, the Voting Rights Act passed and was signed into law. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. But 59 years later, there are forces taking us back in time. Voter suppression, election subversion, unlimited dark money, extreme gerrymandering. John Lewis is a great friend to many of us here, but if you truly want to honor him and all the heroes who marched with him, then it's time to do more than talk. Pass the Freedom to Vote Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And stop denying another core value of America, our diversity across American life, banning books. It's wrong. Instead of erasing history, let's make history. I want to protect fundamental rights. Pass the Equality Act. And my message to transgender Americans, I have your back. Pass the PRO Act for workers' rights. Raise the federal minimum wage, because every worker has a right to a decent living more than $7 an hour. We're also making history by confronting the climate crisis, not denying it. I don't think any of you think there's no longer a climate crisis. At least I hope you don't. I'm taking the most significant action ever on climate in the history of the world. I'm cutting our carbon emissions in half by 2030, creating tens of thousands of clean energy jobs, like the IBEW workers building and installing 500,000 electric vehicle charging stations. Conserving 30% of America's lands and waters by 2030. And taking action on environmental justice fence line communities smothered by the legacy of pollution. And patterned after the Peace Corps and America Corps, I launched the Climate Corps to put 20,000 young people to work in the forefront of our clean energy future. I'll triple that number in a decade. To state the obvious, all Americans deserve the freedom to be safe. And America is safer today than when I took office. Year before I took office, murder rates went up 30%. 30% they went up. The biggest increase in history. It was then, through my American Rescue Plan, which every American voted against, I might add, we made the largest investment in public safety ever. Last year, the murder rate saw the sharpest decrease in history. Violent crime fell to one of its lowest levels in more than 50 years. But we have more to do. We have to help cities invest in more community police officers, more mental health workers, more community violence intervention. Give communities the tool to crack down on gun crime, retail crime, and carjacking. Keep building trust, as I've been doing, by taking executive action on police reform and calling for it to be the law of the land. Directing my cabinet to review the federal classification of marijuana and expunging thousands of convictions for the mere possession, because no one should be jailed for simply using or having it on their record. Take on crimes of domestic violence. I'm ramping up the federal enforcement of the Violence Against Women Act that I proudly wrote when I was a senator, so we can finally, finally end the scourge against women in America. There are other kinds of violence I want to stop. With us tonight is Jasmine, whose 9-year-old sister Jackie was murdered with 21 classmates and teachers in elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. Very soon after that happened, Jill and I went to Uvalde for a couple of days. We spent hours and hours with each of the families. We heard their message, so everyone in this room, in this chamber, could hear the same message. The constant refrain, and I was there for hours meeting with every family. They said, do something. Do something. Well, I did do something by establishing the first ever Office of Gun Violence Prevention in the White House. That the Vice President is leading the charge. Thank you for doing it. Meanwhile, my predecessor told the NRA he's proud he did nothing on guns when he was president. Oof. After another shooting in Iowa recently, he said, when asked what to do about it, he said, just get over it. There's his quote, just get over it. I say, stop it. Stop it, stop it, stop it. Yeah. I'm proud we beat the NRA when I signed the most significant gun safety law in nearly 30 years because of this Congress. We now must beat the NRA again. I'm demanding a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Pass universal background checks. None of this. None of this. I taught the Second Amendment for 12 years. None of this violates the Second Amendment or vilifies responsible gun owners. You know, as we manage challenges at home, we're also managing crises abroad, including in the Middle East. I know the last 5 months have been gut-wrenching for so many people, for the Israeli people, for the Palestinian people, and so many here in America. This crisis began on October 7th with a massacre by a terrorist group called Hamas, as you all know. 1,200 innocent people, women and girls, men and boys, slaughtered after enduring sexual violence. The deadliest day for the Jewish people since the Holocaust, and 250 hostages taken. Here in this chamber tonight are families whose loved ones are still being held by Hamas. I pledge to all the families that we will not rest until we bring every one of your loved ones home. We also we will also work around the clock to bring home Evan and Paul, Americans being unjustly detained by the Russians and others around the world. Israel has the right to go after Hamas. Hamas ended this conflict by releasing hostages, laying down arms, could end it by releasing the hostages, laying down arms, and surrendering those responsible for October 7th. But Israel has an added burden because Hamas hides and operates among the civilian population like cowards under hospitals, daycare centers, and all the like. Israel also has a fundamental responsibility, though, to protect innocent civilians in Gaza. This war has taken a greater toll on innocent civilians than all previous wars in Gaza combined. More than 30,000 Palestinians have been killed, most of whom are not Hamas. Thousands and thousands of innocents, women and children, girls and boys, also orphaned. Nearly 2 million more Palestinians under bombardment or displacement. Homes destroyed, neighborhoods in rubble, cities in ruin. Families without food, water, medicine. It's heartbreaking. I've been working nonstop to establish an immediate ceasefire that would last for 6 weeks to get all the prisoners released, all the hostages released, to get the hostages home and ease the intolerable and humanitarian crisis and build toward something more enduring. The United States has been leading international efforts to get more humanitarian assistance to Gaza. Tonight, I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters. No U.S. boots will be on the ground. A temporary pier will enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day. And Israel must do its part. Israel must allow more aid into Gaza to ensure humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire. And they're announcing they're going to have a crossing in northern Gaza. To the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority. As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time. And I say this as a lifelong supporter of Israel. My entire career, no one has a stronger record with Israel than I do. I challenge any of you here. I'm the only American president to visit Israel in wartime. But there is no other path that guarantees Israel's security and democracy. There is no other path that guarantees Palestinians can live in peace with peace and dignity. And there's no other path that guarantees peace between Israel and all of its neighbors, including Saudi Arabia, with whom I'm talking. Creating stability in the Middle East also means containing the threat posed by Iran. That's why I built a coalition of more than a dozen countries to defend international shipping and freedom of navigation in the Red Sea. I've ordered strikes to degrade the Houthi capability and defend U.S. forces in the region. As Commander-in-Chief, I will not hesitate to direct further measures to protect our people and our military personnel. For years, I've heard many of my Republican and Democratic friends say that China is on the rise and America's falling behind. They've got it backwards. I've been saying it for over 4 years, even when I wasn't president. America's rising. We have the best economy in the world. And since I've come to office, our GDP is up, our trade deficit with China is down to the lowest point in over a decade. And we're standing up against China's unfair economic practices. We're standing up for peace and stability across the Taiwan Straits. I've revitalized our partnership and alliance in the Pacific. India, Australia, Japan, South Korea, Pacific Islands. I've made sure that the most advanced American technologies can't be used in China, not allowing to trade them there. Frankly, for all this tough talk on China, it never occurred to my predecessor to do any of that. I want competition with China, not conflict. And we're in a stronger position to win the conflict of the 21st century against China than anyone else, for that matter, than any time as well. Here at home, I've signed over 400 bipartisan bills. But there's more to pass my unity agenda. Strengthen penalties on fentanyl trafficking. You don't want to do that, huh? Pass bipartisan privacy legislation to protect our children online. Harness the promise of AI to protect us from peril. Ban AI voice impersonations and more. And keep our truly sacred obligation to train and equip those we send into harm's way and care for them and their families when they come home and when they don't. That's why the song Support and Help of Dennis and the VA, I signed the PACT Act, one of the most significant laws ever, helping millions of veterans exposed to toxins who now are battling more than 100 different cancers. Many of them don't come home, but we owe them and their families support. We owe it to ourselves to keep supporting our new health research agency called ARPA-H. And remind us that we can do big things, like end cancer as we know it, and we will. Let me close with this. Yeah. I know you don't want to hear any more, Lindsay, but I got to say a few more things. I know it may not look like it, but I've been around a while. When you get to be my age, certain things become clearer than ever. I know the American story. Again and again, I've seen the contest between competing forces and the battle for the soul of our nation, between those who want to pull America back to the past and those who want to move America into the future. My lifetime has taught me to embrace freedom and democracy, a future based on core values that have defined America: honesty, decency, dignity, equality, to respect everyone, to give everyone a fair shot, to give hate no safe harbor. Now, other people my age see it differently. The American story of resentment, revenge, and retribution. That's not me. I was born amid World War II, when America stood for the freedom of the world. I grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Claymont, Delaware, among working-class people who built this country. I watched in horror as two of my heroes, like many of you did, Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy, were assassinated. And their legacies inspired me to pursue a career in service. I left the law firm and became a public defender because my city of Wilmington was the only city in America occupied by the National Guard after Dr. King was assassinated because of the riots. And I became a county councilman almost by accident. I got elected to the United States Senate when I had no intention of running at age 29. Then vice president of our first black president. Now president to the first women vice president. In my career, I've been told I was too young. By the way, they didn't let me on the Senate elevators for votes sometimes. Not a joke. And I've been told I'm too old. Whether young or old, I've always known what endures. I've known our North Star. The very idea of America is that we're all created equal and deserves to be treated equally throughout our lives. We've never fully lived up to that idea, but we've never walked away from it either. And I won't walk away from it now. I'm optimistic. I really am. I'm optimistic, Nancy. My fellow Americans, the issue facing our nation isn't how old we are, it's how old are our ideas. Hate, anger, revenge, retribution are the oldest of ideas. But you can't lead America with ancient ideas that only take us back. You lead America, the land of possibilities. You need a vision for the future and what can and should be done. Tonight you've heard mine. I see a future where defending democracy, you don't diminish it. I see a future where we restore the right to choose and protect our freedoms, not take them away. I see a future where the middle class finally has a fair shot and the wealthy have to pay their fair share in taxes. I see a future where we save the planet from the climate crisis and our country from gun violence. Above all, I see a future for all Americans. I see a country for all Americans. And I will always be president for all Americans. Because I believe in America. I believe in you, the American people. You're the reason we've never been more optimistic about our future than I am now. So let's build the future together. Let's remember who we are. We are the United States of America. And there is nothing, nothing beyond our capacity when we act together. God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Clocking in at just under 70 minutes.
So we are both wrong.
We are both wrong.
We had the under.
I have to say my immediate impressions are this. An incredibly strong performance from the president. He has made an affirmative case. He handled the disruptions in the chamber, I think, with aplomb. He took on the tough issues. And again, I think he tried to remind everyone listening of the basic American values and drew an extraordinarily sharp contrast between his vision, his orientation towards the future, his affirmation of American values, and the MAGA presidents, former presidents. I think it was an extremely effective speech overall. I think a strong showing from President Biden tonight.
Yeah, and I'm not going so much on the content. It's the delivery that I'm not saying it's off-putting. It just wasn't a great delivery. In times, it just got too quick. There was a lot of words that kind of got mushed together. It was kind of tough. I think there could have been more punchy lines, more of an effective delivery if some of these lines that he was prepared had gotten out. I think it was a little bit disjointed. And I don't think it did anything to reassure any voter that may have thought that maybe this guy's not in it for the long haul. I don't know that this reassured anybody.
I'm actually going to disagree with that.
Okay.
Really strongly. Joe Biden has never been known as a great orator. He has a speech impediment. He grew up with a stutter.
I know about the stutter, right. But this was more of a like.
I want to talk about the pacing. So when you you've got speechwriters and others who prepare the president for these State of the Union speeches, one of the things that they work a lot on is where to make the breaks and where actually to speed up. I have no doubt that part of what he was told was don't take too long. You need to move through this content. You need to not create a lot of big gaps for heckling. You saw him talking through the applause. He wanted to get his points across. I think the strength of his presentation were many of the points of critical emphasis. Those key points came across, and they came across forcefully. I actually believe that this would reassure many voters, and here's why. There is no way that the MAGA candidate can talk as articulately as this president just did in at this level of detail, despite what may be pacing imperfections. And I'll grant you that this isn't an orator's perfect day, but it's an extremely effective speech, emphasizing the fair share, what he's doing for the middle class, again, a vision for the future. If I'm an average person sitting at home, yeah, he talks quickly. Some of the words aren't perfectly articulated.
I'm thinking of my mom at home watching this and just kind of putting myself in her place. And I know when she's watching a show and somebody's talking too quick, she's like, well, slow down now a little bit. And I'm trying to put myself in the position of, again, somebody like my mom who's watching and sees that. And I don't know that the other thing about it wasn't really a unity speech. Would you think that he's more trying to get turnout with this or try and peel off some voters that wouldn't necessarily vote for him?
The great question of who President Biden's audience was in this speech has been much discussed, right?
Right.
The target here is to reassure his base, the Democratic loyal, in my opinion, and it's to target not the MAGA Looney Tunes, the guy that got, if you weren't watching it and just listening to it, the guy that was shouting and
I think
at some point
13 dead Marines is what the person at the end was shouting.
Okay.
Now I'm not sure. I know that has something to do with Afghanistan, but it really wasn't in context with what he was saying at the time.
No, he was talking about crime. It had nothing to do with war or foreign policy. There was some nut job that was hauled out of, I think, the Spectator's gallery. Interesting to note, it's in that very same Spectator's gallery where we saw members of Congress donning gas masks and hiding during January 6th. 13 Marines, yes. Threatening the lives of members of Congress, also a problem. Despite the sort of distracting antics from, of course, Marjorie Taylor Greene, just an aside here. It really is emblematic of the disruption and the negative impact of severe gerrymanders to watch Marjorie Taylor Greene behave like that, right? Because other than ruby red districts, someone doesn't think they can get away with that because they'd turn off voters. But to return to your point, talking about voters and who's the audience, I think he's targeting some of those middle class folks that want to know, what is Joe Biden doing for me? I'm just a regular person going to my job. What is Joe Biden doing to make my life better? And I think he made that affirmative case incredibly well, ticking off prescription drug prices, protection of Medicare and Medicaid. He called out specific Republican policy points and said, I will prevent them from increasing the age that you qualify for Social Security. Time and time again, he put forward a middle-class focused policy agenda. And I think that speaks to people. One of the strongest moments in that whole speech, in my estimation, was when he was talking about the taxation policies that he wants to pursue and that our Democratic linchpins and pieces of Democratic policy platforms for many years versus what Donald Trump did to the economy and making the rich even richer. I think that was a big highlight of this speech. I think he drove that point home extremely well. He ended with it to have the rich pay their fair share so that every American has their fair shot. I think that resonates. People understand the tax system is broken.
And it should be noted that his son is under indictment for tax evasion. I mean, I think that's at least a little bit in the conversation of if you're talking about taxes and people paying their fair share. At least I think I had to bring that up as somebody in the news media. The people that I find fascinating, and I thought this is why I ask who's being targeted, is the Obama-Trump voter. After Trump was elected, Larry Sabato put together some numbers.
Yep.
8.5 million people voted for Obama. 8.5 million people, those same people voted for Trump. And I think that is a fascinating story that kind of gets left out.
Well, I think that's who he's targeting, don't you? I think he's trying to go after.
I'm not sure that was it. I mean, your number one thing on the polling was the border, and that didn't get that much time. Inflation, the economy, I don't know that got that much time. And I think that Obama-Trump voter is something that those two issues was something that they'd be kind of focusing on.
Yeah. I think he approached the immigration question. He articulated, you need to pass this bill. Do so. This is what we need to do to secure the border. Those are the basic facts, that there is the strongest immigration bill in over a decade before this Congress and that the former president prevents it from going forward. And as far as tax evasion goes, yeah, Hunter Biden is not his dad. And when you talk about the amount of money that Hunter Biden owes in taxes, which he will have to pay, is so vastly outstripped by the corporate tax breaks. I mean, all of this stuff in context, I hate to pick a bone here, and I always like having the discussion. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a relevant point as a newsman
to point out. And I know that this is a point that you're going to have to combat from the other side.
Of course.
This is one of those things that's observational.
Well, this is, I mean, it's akin to people saying, Hunter Biden got a job with Burisma because his dad was vice president. I say, yeah, to what end?
right? Well, I'm just
Jared again. Kushner's cashing a $40 million check from the Saudis every year because he stood up for the guy that assassinated a Washington Post journalist.
And I guess what I'm getting at is there's going to be Republicans out there that'll break it down by saying Joe Biden thinks you should pay your fair share. And his son is under indictment for not paying his fair share. They'll be able to break that down into a couple of second sentences.
I don't like to do their work for them.
Well, I think it's better to at least everybody is at least knowing what is out there and what you're going to have to be dealing with. The president's still in the room shaking hands.
Of course. And the point and what gets lost in those sort of Republican rebuttals is what I call the elevation of micro to the detriment of the big picture. In other words, you take the detail to refute the overall policy objective or the overall massive impacts of an $8 trillion increase in our deficit. Hunter Biden pays his taxes. It's not going to do a damn thing for the middle class, but corporations and the richest 1% of Americans dodging taxes legally.
I knew you'd have an answer for it. This is why I bring it up.
While not a crime, does so much more harm not only to our nation, not only to our economic prospects, but to every middle class American. So it's those kinds of things. I think, again, my overall impression is it was a strong showing from the president. I don't know about you, but the prospect of speaking for 70 minutes in front of that chamber at my age, 47, I wouldn't want to do. And again, when I think about, I mean, frankly, you could stack up the Joe Biden State of the Union today against Donald Trump's rambling, I don't even know what you call it, victory speech on Super Tuesday. And yeah, one guy has his marbles together and one doesn't. And it's Joe Biden that actually understands the issues that are important to Americans.
Right. And I think what going into it, it's there's been discussion about him being able to get through this. And I don't know that that would be there for you. What I find interesting, and maybe I kind of want to get your thoughts, he's in front of this massive audience, the biggest audience he's going to be in front of until right. the election. Why didn't he take advantage of that kind of viewership for the Super Bowl? Why didn't he take that offer to do that interview, to sit in front of CBS News and take that audience? You've got an election coming up. Why do you think that was avoided?
Strange, right? Yeah, I can't get in the president's strategist's head on that. I think it was a miss. When somebody gives you a big old platform, general political wisdom would say to take it.
Right, especially when you have calls out there for people saying you're not able to do it.
Right, or you haven't been seen in a while. One possible rationale for that is that interview, given its format and length, it's very difficult to actually do what Joe Biden is really good at, and which, frankly, the State of the Union isn't the best format for Joe Biden, and that is to talk about the details of policy. And that particular interview format, again, I would have told him to take the interview, make your big picture points. It doesn't feed well. It doesn't support what Joe Biden is really, truly great at, which is wonk policy. The guy has been doing this for a long time. I do think a few of the moments at both the beginning and the end of his speech that I think played really well was making fun of himself. One of the things, and this worked really well in Wisconsin for Governor Evers, was Governor Evers, like Joe Biden, Joe Biden's a more captivating speaker than Tony Evers is. Tony Evers debates with Tim Michaels from an oratorical standpoint. Tim Michaels beat Tony Evers. But what Wisconsinites responded to, and I think Wisconsinites are one of the audiences that Joe Biden, right, we started
almost
with that.
The only important audiences right. in the country.
Well, can't win it without us, right? One of the things that folks responded to about Tony Evers was he felt like someone they knew. He spoke from the heart. And there is an accessibility about Joe Biden, even with his cadence missteps, even with his words coming together a bit. He feels like somebody you could actually sit down and have a conversation with. And while people may be inflamed by Donald Trump, I don't know anybody who's like, yeah, I could actually have breakfast with the guy and it would be a decent conversation. He's not that kind of a dude. And that lack of relatability of Donald Trump is what I think is one of his weaknesses that doesn't get talked about enough. Joe Biden is a regular guy from a regular family who has risen to the highest office in the land. Donald Trump grew up with a silver spoon jammed up his butt and basically has bankrupted nearly all of his businesses and looks on par to do it again while proclaiming to himself dodge taxes and that as a personal creditable, like, that makes me smart and good. No, it makes you a tax cheat. Maybe not a criminal one, just a rich one that can hire really good accountants and lawyers.
Given that that's your thought, should we be expecting to see Joe Biden here a lot campaigning, not just by himself, but do you expect him here with congressional candidates? Do you expect him to be making appearances with Tammy Baldwin? Do you think that they're...
He's not... Tammy, unless polling shows Hovde coming up on Tammy, that Joe Biden will not waste his time with any of the senatorial or House seats, unless they're close ones, where it's really going to make a difference, right? In other words, you got to be really selective about where he shows up. He's got plenty of surrogates, including a vice president and others, even his wife, who does a great job, was just here in Milwaukee. So all those things, I think, will go into that decision-making about where Joe Biden shows up. But what I expect to see more of, and he's been doing a lot of this, not the big speeches, but it's the two things that I've been emphasizing about what worked here. And that is, he does understand policy. He does know the details. He has a message about where this country needs to go. And it's a message that works for everybody in the middle class, right? That is a pro for Joe Biden because he knows what he wants to do and he knows how to get there. You don't know damn squat nothing except for maybe build the wall about Donald Trump. And the second thing is, and this is what you're seeing in the Biden campaign, and you're going to see more of it, is what I call kitchen table politicking. In small groups, in small places, eating ice cream, having a bubble tea, you know, when he was out in California. These kinds of things that really make him accessible, knowable, and somebody that you feel like you can touch and feel and actually and really relate to. He's going to lean into the relatability. I think that works for him. I think it especially works in places like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. A guy like John Fetterman doesn't get elected if people don't care about relatability, even though John Fetterman has his own verbal missteps because of his challenges. Tony Evers, real smart guy, an administrator, not a charismatic dude, but he's relatable. And I like to believe that people want to see leaders that reflect themselves, that speak to the values that unite. And there were portions of this speech that I thought were uniting moments. We even saw Speaker Johnson nodding a bit at some of those moments, grimaced in others, shook his head in others. But the idea that you can't love your country only when you win. One of his early opening lines, and I think that resonates. I think people believe that. I think people want to return to those values. I think people want to make America normal again.
I want to go back and cover some of those kind of, not really, not the gaffes, but the outbursts. If you didn't want to start thinking about that, the president is still in the room. He's signing things. He's taking his time. He's there talking to anybody that's still standing around. And again, we will be taking the Republican response once that does start. But again, going back to the speech, some of those outbursts, the one we covered that you talked about, somebody that was not in not in the lower portion, but in the upper portion.
In other words, not an elected official.
Not an elected official and not a guest of an elected official.
Correct.
Had an outburst about Marines. A lot of shouting about the lying. I know I heard three or four lies. And then the one with
Gates was the first one out of the box. I think when they were on the tapes back, it was right when he was talking about we have to be focused on a way forward. We came through the pandemic, the economic downturn, and Donald Trump failed in the president's most fundamental duty to the American people, and that is the duty to care. And I'm 90% sure it was Gates that screamed out, lie.
And I'm trying to look now, and it's tough to do this while we're all live here, but I thought I'd seen something about Congressman Van Orden possibly at some point.
Well, that would be
raising his voice.
Right, get drunk in your congressional office and then go berate a bunch of congressional interns in the rotunda, scream out at the president during the State of the Union. You know, just par for the course for Derek.
And it was more of an extended exchange between the president and Marjorie Taylor Greene. She had been wanting him to say the name of Lakin Riley from Georgia. She was murdered by somebody who was not in the country legally. So a couple of follow-ups on that. The president was given a coin of some sort with her name and telling her story. I think Marjorie Taylor Greene gave him that, not expecting him to actually read it. And it was kind of a surprise that he said, I'm going to say her name.
Except, and he pulled it up.
But he said Lincoln Riley, who is the coach of the USC Trojans.
I couldn't hear it clearly.
Yeah, and it was kind of got lost in there. So he did say her name, but he didn't say her name. And that was kind of an extended going back and forth. So that's something you're going to see kind of repeated as the pundits take that and move along with it.
I mean, I have some names to say. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, right? I could go on. One of the themes in this speech from Joe Biden was that every American life matters. And that is something that we all should be able to get behind, right? The shared dignity of each one of us. This was a speech about doing the right thing. And that to me was a refreshing moment. Again, a future orientation, a positive vision about doing the right thing. That's powerful. I also think it's worthy of mention that Lake and Riley's family declined an invitation from a GOP representative to attend the State of the Union. I think that says quite a bit. Now, the spin from that representative was in their grief process.
I wouldn't want to be anywhere near any of the, especially politicians at this point.
No kidding. But notable nonetheless. The other thing that I actually talked about this yesterday on my show, and it's the idea of what I term performative politics. And what that is, politics is theater. We all understand. Oh, here we go with the Republican rebuttal.
Alabama Senator Katie Britt, youngest GOP woman elected to the U.S. Senate.
Great state of Alabama and the United States Senate. However, that's not the job that matters most. I am a proud wife and mom of two school-aged kids. My daughter Bennett and my son Ridgeway are why I ran for the Senate. I'm worried about their future and the future of children in every corner of our nation. And that's why I invited you into our home tonight. Like so many families across America, my husband Wesley and I just watched President Biden's State of the Union address from our living room. And what we saw was the performance of a permanent politician who has actually been in office for longer than I've been alive. One thing was quite clear, though. President Biden just doesn't get it. He's out of touch. Under his administration, families are worse off, our communities are less safe, and our country is less secure. I just wish he understood what real families are facing around kitchen tables just like this one. You know, this is where our family has tough conversations. It's where we make hard decisions. It's where we share the good, the bad, and the ugly of our days. It's where we laugh together. And it's where we hold each other's hands and pray for God's guidance. And many nights, to be honest, it's where Wesley and I worry. I know we're not alone. And so tonight, the American family needs to have a tough conversation. Because the truth is, we're all worried about the future of our nation. The country we know and love seems to be slipping away, and it feels like the next generation will have fewer opportunities and less freedoms than we did. I worry my own children may not even get a shot at living their American dreams. My American dream allowed me, the daughter of two small business owners from rural Enterprise, Alabama, to be elected to the United States Senate at the age of 40. Growing up, sweeping the floor at my dad's hardware store and cleaning the bathroom at my mom's dance studio, I never could have imagined what my story would entail. To think about what the American dream can do across just one generation, in just one lifetime, it's truly breathtaking. But right now, the American dream has turned into a nightmare for so many families. The true, unvarnished state of our union begins and ends with this. Our families are hurting. Our country can do better. And you don't have to look any further than the crisis at our southern border to see it. President Biden inherited the most secure border of all time. But minutes after taking office, he suspended all deportations, he halted construction of the border wall, and he announced a plan to give amnesty to millions. We know that President Biden didn't just create this border crisis, he invited it with 94 executive actions in his first 100 days. When I took office, I took a different approach. I traveled to the Del Rio sector of Texas. That's where I spoke to a woman who shared her story with me. She had been sex trafficked by the cartels starting at the age of 12. She told me not just that she was raped every day, but how many times a day she was raped. The cartels put her on a mattress in a shoebox of a room, and they sent men through that door over and over again for hours and hours on end. We wouldn't be okay with this happening in a third world country. This is the United States of America, and it is past time, in my opinion, that we start acting like it. President Biden's border policies are a disgrace. This crisis is despicable. And the truth is, it is almost entirely preventable. From fentanyl poisonings to horrific murders, there are empty chairs tonight at kitchen tables just like